This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Gregory Copley, the editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs. Importantly, he's in Perth, Australia. We've commented on the new Australian government looking north and east towards the Oceania Islands, this vast canvas of the earth. Now we look from Perth to the west, to the vast Indian Ocean. And in the Indian Ocean is a profoundly troubled governance, Sri Lanka. The headline from Reuters, Colombo, the capital. Sri Lanka wants farmers to plant more rice as part of plans to avert a severe food shortage. A top official said, as experts warned of a 50% drop in production that would worsen the impact of the already severe financial crisis. The severe financial crisis is a governance crisis. We also have reports of inflation in Sri Lanka at 40%. There is demand for fuel. There's demand for cooking oil. There's demand for food. The government is in turmoil over decisions made by one particular family, the Rajapaksas, these last years. But China is a player. And Gregory, you've guided me to the game of ports, the stretch of the Indian Ocean from Djibouti all the way to the Indonesia. And one of the ports, as I recall, is Colombo. The generosity of the People's Republic of China these last years is said to be a driver towards the poor decision-making by the Rajapaksas, building an airport that is not used and other luxuries for their family. The People's Republic of China now, is this a success to have the economy of Sri Lanka collapsing, the food lines, orders to the army to shoot on sight for protesters at Colombo? Is this what PRC needs in order to take over governance?
Well, they're not going to take over governance there, but they are going to see Sri Lanka in turmoil for the next couple of years. And that's going to be a major concern, is a major concern for the government of India, literally just across the straits. So it allows the PRC to have some access, although that'll be fairly limited in the next few years. But the chaos in Sri Lanka will have an effect, for example, in the neighbouring Indian states, where you have also a lot of Tamil people there, as you do in Sri Lanka. But in the short term, of course, you've got an enormous problem because of the variety of breakdowns within the government. The outgoing prime minister had basically demanded that chemical fertilizers be no longer used. That led to an immediate collapse in food production, which has not been recovered. So you had farmers driven off the land over the last year. They are going to have grave difficulty getting back on it to build the rice and tea crops for the coming year. There's some relief being given to the importation of chemical fertilizers, but it's too little too late. So they're going to have a major food crisis over the next few months before even the next maha cultivation season starts, when the big rice producing season. They say they'll be once more rice independent by 2023, but the government's going to have difficulty surviving until that point. As you pointed out, the inflation level in Sri Lanka just for May rose to 39.1% because they just had 2 years of money printing, which, of course, didn't resolve the problems. So you've got food shortages, you've got inflation, you've got mass protests in the streets. The prime minister, who was part of the Rajapaksa family, resigned, but you've still got President Rajapaksa as the head of state. And he's actually invited in a key opposition figure and a many-time former prime minister, Wickremesinghe, this new prime minister who'd been in the opposition, has a memorandum of understanding with President Rajapaksa, and they are hoping to, if you like, patch together a unity government which will save the country. But they've got fuel shortages. They have no money at all to pay for imports of either food or fuel. So even airlines visiting Sri Lanka are now told that their aircraft must be full when they depart for Sri Lanka, because they will not be able to refuel in the country. So this is pretty dire straits, and something which we thought could not happen in so quickly in a country which was more or less fairly advanced in its economy. It had a diverse economy with tourism, with the tea exports and with other exports as well, a viable agricultural industry, and yet everything has collapsed overnight and won't be resurrected, you know, this year, that's for sure.
The lavish spending includes, according to the New York Times reporting, $1 billion spent on a port. And I want to concentrate on that port because it's been handed over to the Chinese, the People's Republic of China, according to the New York Times. This is part of the string of pearls that begins, I think, in Pakistan, unless there's something farther east, to Colombo and to Djibouti, and then looking to develop that string of pearls into the Atlantic. Is that still an active program by the PRC? Are they still building for the long term to command their war fleet across the Indian Ocean?
The Chinese global ports strategy, where they've been acquiring the management or control of ports in Southwest Africa, on the African East Coast, in the Mediterranean, in Latin America, in Australia. This is not just about being able to deploy the PLA Navy. That's actually a very, very secondary consideration, because it's awkward for them to do that in normal times to many of these ports. But it does give the PRC the ability to control some of the exports and imports from those countries. The acquisition of a 99-year lease to of the port of Darwin in Australia, for example, was about being able to control beef exports from Australia to China, which have been critical. And it's been, obviously, there are long-term prospects in some of these ports for naval visits and for intelligence collection and the like, and for denying the ports to, for example, the United States. But the ports can be very strategic. The one real naval port which the PLA Navy now has is, of course, in Djibouti, which they were given by the Djibouti government when then Secretary of State Kerry of the United States basically attacked and criticized the president of Djibouti and said that the United States would not allow him to run for a fourth term in office, and said, implying that the then Obama administration would depose the or do a regime change on the presidency of Djibouti. As a result, the Djibouti president withdrew one of the U.S. naval bases in Djibouti and gave it to the People's Liberation Army Navy. So now you've got this PRC naval port in Djibouti. That's the first one. You've, of course, got the big port in which they built in Pakistan. So that's very critical to the PRC's ability to import and export through Pakistan and up across the land bridge into the People's Republic of China proper. So that's very critical. Sri Lanka has been a key point where they hoped to have some, if you like, domination of influence in the Indian Ocean. More particularly, they've got control over assets in Myanmar, because that of course allows them to run from China proper down into the Indian Ocean through Myanmar, and that again was something which the United States gave to Beijing, because the Obama administration and now the Biden administration have been highly critical of the generals who run Myanmar. So the Myanmarese generals then said, well, okay, we have to go back and build our relations with Beijing. And that's what they've done, that rather reluctantly. And, of course, you've got the PRC working very closely but cautiously with Indonesia, with Timor-Leste, Papua New Guinea, and of course, over onto to the Solomons and Kiribati and the like.
The Secretary of State, Mr. Blinken, made a statement about China in these last days, Gregory. And because you've been traveling, we haven't had a chance to exchange. But your thoughts on this. However, there seems to be a passage here that, though it doesn't bite, it does suggest that the U.S. is competing with China in these geographies. We will invest in the foundations of our strength here and at home. Here at home, our competitiveness, our innovation, our democracy. We will align our efforts with our network of allies and partners, acting with common purpose and in common cause, said the secretary. And harnessing these two key assets, we'll compete with China to defend our interests and build our vision for the future. Now, let's look at the Indian Ocean. Is the U.S. competing with China in this string of pearls being constructed? Is this a partnership and a confrontation? How is it seen from Australia's point of view? Is the U.S. holding up its own in the Indian Ocean?
Well, the U.S. has been fairly quiet on the Indian Ocean and the Pacific since the arrival of the Biden administration. Frankly, the Biden administration has deliberately and very, very pointedly reoriented U.S. strategic activities to the Euro-Atlantic region, particularly since the U.S. Pushed the Ukraine-Russia war to occur. And that seems to be the comfort level of the Biden administration. And President Biden has more or less not mentioned China for the last year and a half, even on his visit to Japan for the quadrilateral meeting, the Quad meeting with India, Australia, Japan, and the U.S. He was more concerned about getting the Quad members to sign up to a statement condemning Russia, rather than, you know, the Quad's main purpose, which is to contain the People's Republic of China. Now, he did say, accidentally, in answer to a question, that the U.S. would defend Taiwan from the People's Republic of China. But then the State Department immediately walked that statement back, and President Biden was very cautious about anything he said thereafter. But look, Australia, as a result of that initial statement by President Biden in Tokyo, has become slightly more free to talk about the defense of Taiwan as being important to Australia. So that was a step forward. But, you know, we have to say that the Biden administration doesn't seem to care about the People's Republic of China. It's happy to help the People's Republic of China by distracting all of the deployment and interest over under the Russia-Ukraine conflict. And this has allowed the PRC to expand its operations into the Indo-Pacific much more dramatically. Basically, what we haven't seen is any serious political support in the Biden administration for the AUKUS treaty. Now, the new Australian Labor government is going to support AUKUS because it's really a good deal for Australia and it's a good deal for the United Kingdom. It would be a good deal for the US, but President Biden hasn't given it any real attention. At a working level, the US Department of Defense has clearly seen this as a great opportunity and is working to expand that. But you know, frankly, the question we ask in the Indo-Pacific today is, where is the United States? And Secretary of State Blinken's statement was fairly ambiguous and not very, shall we say, strong on the defense of the Taiwan and the Republic of China or against the People's Republic of China.
Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs. He's in Perth, Australia. Gregory mentions Europe, and we're headed to Ukraine. Developments in the Donbass region, Russia advance. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.